Al Michaels had his miracle moment, and I have to say I did too. I used the miracle word in my call of the last seconds of the game and the conclusion.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. On this episode, we remember the Lake Placid Olympics on the 40th anniversary of the Games. A number of athletes who competed are returning to the village to reminisce with residents who helped organize or volunteered during the Games. Three people who worked behind the scenes spoke with WAMC North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley. Marina LeDuc was a press photographer, among those selected to travel to Greece on Air Force Two to get the Olympic flame.
Well, Mondale offered his Air Force plane for us to go to Athens. So the plane flew into Plattsburgh Air Force Base, and we flew over and we refueled at an Air Force base in England. And they had the red carpet out, and they gave us breakfast with all the silverware. And then we took off to go to Athens. And because we were ahead of time, the pilot said, "Would you like to see the Alps?" So he flew around the Alps. Then he flew around to Elba, where Napoleon had been, or St. Helens, whichever one it was. We flew around that. And then we flew into Athens, but we weren't allowed to come to the airport itself. We were way at the other part of the field. In the minute our plane hit the ground, we had machine guns protecting us. So then they took us by motorcycle escort to our hotels. So we were there, I think, 5 days, if I remember right, maybe four. And we were treated like royalty. We had diplomatic passports for this trip. We had some athletes with us, so they would go out in the morning and just do their little bit to keep themselves in shape. Then they took us to the Acropolis, and then we had the Olympic Committee gave us a dinner, the ambassador gave us a dinner, the Greek government gave us a dinner. Then we flew down to where they have the flame, where Zeus comes down and gives us the flame. So there was quite a ceremony there. So the goddess would call up to Zeus to send his lightning down. And the flame was put into a miner's lamp so that it would be safe in the plane. So then we flew back to Washington. Well, they took us over to Shannon Airport. And they closed the airport. It was late at night, but they opened all the stores up for us. So it was great. We got to do our duty-free shopping. So then we flew into Andrews Air Force Base. And from there, we went to the White House, to the Oval Office. And Carter met us at the door and shook hands and said hello to everybody. He was really, really nice. But I was standing right beside his desk, and there was a folder on it, and it said, "For your eyes only." So I was trying to get a good look at it. And all of a sudden, I got a tap on my shoulder, and I looked over. And it was a Secret Service guy, and he just nodded his head for me to move it over. And after about 2 weeks, I got a photograph with me shaking hands with Carter. And he had signed it to Marina from Jimmy Carter, which was really nice.
So you said that it was in a special container on the plane.
Right. It was just, it was about 4 or 5 inches tall, and it was contained. There must have been butane or something in the bottom to keep it going. But the Air Force had said we couldn't have any open flames on the plane for safety's sake.
Marina, why were you among those selected to go and get the flame?
Well, I was a press photographer in Canada. I worked for the Ottawa Citizen, the Montreal Star, and finally the Montreal Gazette. And then I also had been working, when I got married and came down to Plattsburgh from Montreal, I went to work for Channel 5. So I was a news camerawoman for Channel 5 for 2 years. So I had background, a lot of press background. and I could shoot stills as well as video. At that time, it was 60 millimeter film. So I was, instead of sending two people, they could send one.
So you were basically a press representative.
Right.
Speaking of press representatives, Jack LaDuc, currently your husband, was also involved in the 1980 Olympics. You were one of the press representatives, weren't you?
Well, I was the audiovisual director.
And you had to coordinate all of the national press that came in, right?
Well, all the photographic and still photography and video press that came in. It was at a time when video was just coming in, and a lot of the video cameras, the recording decks were mechanical, and they had a lot of problems with it. So just about all the motion picture press brought 16 millimeter film cameras with them. And many of the video cameras broke down in 1980. They were new, and a lot of changes had to be made in them before they were capable of withstanding long trips and cold weather. And they were prepared for that.
Well, as the media coordinator, basically, were you able to actually get out and take photographs and shoot any film or video yourself?
Not a lot. Very little, actually. I had to go around and make sure the sites were in proper shape to hold the press, to get them there so they could get the vantage points that they needed. And there were, you know, quite a few sites you had to go to, and that took up a lot of time.
Sandy Caligiuri, what was your role during the 1980 Winter Olympics?
Well, at the time, I worked at WNBZ Radio in Saranac Lake. I was, as you find in many small radio stations, you become a jack of all trades, so that was what I did. But I specialized in sports. And at the time of the Olympics, I put together a little crew of about half a dozen of us to cover the different events, not so much live, but to go out, gather content, interviews, you know, witness what was going on. And then we would do a 30-minute report in the morning, 30-minute report in the early evening. And I did a lot of that anchoring, but I also went out into the field and gathered a lot of the content myself. But we had enough talent that we could cover all the different venues. But we, of course, kept a close eye on the hockey team and how they were progressing. And we decided that if they got to the point where they were playing, you know, for a medal or were in medal contention, we would start picking up the play-by-play. And so that's what we did. Starting with Friday, February 22nd, the game against Russia, we did the play-by-play of that game, and I worked alongside my longtime partner, Tom Fish, was a school teacher at the time in Saranac Lake, and he and I had done years and years of hockey broadcast, local broadcast. So Tom was a color man. And, you know, as luck would have it, all the dominoes tumbled into place nicely, and we got to witness the miracle on ice. And then 2 days later, we got to call the gold medal game when the U.S. beat Finland.
ABC News has that classic quote, "Do you believe in miracles?"
Right.
But you also got a chance to broadcast it. Mm-hmm. Was it as exciting from your booth, from your perspective?
Oh, it was every bit as exciting. You know, I was in the actual press box, whereas TV was on the other side of the rink. They were above the penalty boxes in a special, like, TV tribune. And so being in the press box, it was full because it was such great interest in that game. And, you know, it shook. That plus all the people that were in the building that night, you know, well above the official capacity, the place was very, very loud. And I will remember that. And, of course, from a standpoint of audio, we tried to make sure that the audience, the live audience, didn't drown us out. So we had to work with our mics to make sure that we came across. But, yeah, it was every bit as exciting, as memorable. And, you know, Al Michaels had his miracle moment. And I have to say I did, too. I used the miracle word in my call of the last seconds of the game and the conclusion.
Before Al Michaels?
No, it couldn't be before. It was at the same time. Because we were both broadcasting the game. I was live locally, and Al was live on tape because ABC didn't show it live. They flipped it around and showed it at 8 or 8:30 that night when the game actually ended just before 7:30. But sure, he was live on tape. I was live to the local communities, and you know, we both had the same idea in mind.
Yeah, this was before the days of live satellite feeds and things like that.
Oh, absolutely, so, yeah.
Well, Jack, Sandy, and Marina, everybody remembers the Miracle on Ice from the 1980 Olympics. What other events really stand out in your memory? Or is it events, or is it just the ambiance of the village and everything else going on? I mean, what else stands out for you guys?
Well, just for me, not only the Miracle on Ice and then the ensuing gold medal 2 days later, but Eric Heiden winning his 5 gold medals in speed skating. And that stands out because it's never going to happen again. It hasn't been equaled since. It will not be equaled. Lake Placid was about the end of the road for speed skating outside. It's become very sterile. After 1980, we got into like partially covered buildings. And now it's completely inside. Long track is no longer outside. Eric Heiden, when he won those medals, you have to understand, being in the elements on a 400-meter oval, it was 200 meters downwind and 200 meters into the wind. And when you're buffeted by the wind, it really can play havoc with technique, where nowadays that's out of the equation. There isn't a breath in the event now, whereas back then, you know, you had to pay attention on the wind direction. And what he did, never again to be seen in long track skating. So you have those two, and then the closest cross-country ski race in Olympic history occurred in the middle of the Olympic period when the Swedish racer Thomas Vassberg beat the racer from Finland, Juha Mieto, by a hundredth of a second. The race that went on for over 41 minutes at 15K, that's 9.3 miles, was decided by 0.01 of a second.
Jack, how about you?
Well, one of my most vivid memories are of the construction that took place prior to the Olympics, getting ready for the Olympics. The old Olympic venues were dated back to 1932 for the first Olympics that Lake Placid had. I believe it was the third Winter Olympics. Mm-hmm, yeah. And they had become a little shabby. And so Senator Ron Stafford and Hugh Carey dredged up some money to get the ball rolling to help renovate a lot of the places. And then Congressman Bob McEwen, who was a congressman for this area at the time, went to Congress and pulled out probably quite a few million dollars to build the Olympic Village in Ray Brook, which was a prison. And the Gilbane Construction Company did all the so-called renovations, but in many cases it was a completely new building that they put together. And they did a fabulous job on all the facilities, all the venues that they put together, the arena, the ski jumps, Whiteface Mountain, Luge. And if you remember, there was very little snow at that time. And so to counteract that, to get enough snow, they made snow, man-made snow. And at the entrance to the bobsled and cross-country complex, they put it in a big pile, a huge pile of snow. And trucks would come in and bring it around to the different venues and spread it out. And I don't believe, and Sandy, tell me if I'm wrong here, I don't think there was a venue that wasn't, that artificial snow wasn't put on. Or ice or snow.
Right, no, yeah, that was kind of like the beginning of the artificial technology. I remember I and others thought it was a complete waste of money because we never had an issue with natural snowfall. And it just so happened that that following year, from 79 to 80, when we had not that much snow, thank God we had that capability of making the artificial surfaces.
It has advanced, but even then they had enough knowledge and equipment to turn out a lot of snow and make an Olympics possible. If there ever was a miracle, I think that's one that took place right there.
Marina, what other things do you remember?
The press office for the audiovisual department was in the high school, and we had a window overlooking the Oval, so I could watch Eric Heiden do every one of his laps. And then when the final Miracle on Ice was playing, TASS had its offices down the hall from us.
That's the Russian news agency, TASS.
But they did not have a view of outside. We all had closed circuit TVs, so we were getting play-by-play as it was going on. So every time we scored a goal, one of us had a cowbell, and we'd run down the hall and bring it outside TASS's office. They finally locked their door. So then when the crowds came out, it was just unbelievable. Everybody was yelling and screaming and dancing. And then all of a sudden, the fireworks took off because they were having the presentations on the aisle for the medal presentations. And it just happened at exactly the same time. So it was just unbelievable. And there was just these thousands of people. I don't know where they all came from. The street, everything was just filled with people.
There's more on the 1980 Olympics in Lake Placid, New York at WAMC.org. And a plug for our sister podcast, A New York Minute in History, which has a special episode coming up about the Games. That does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks for listening. Remember to stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.